We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. Odysseus, or maybe you know him better as Ulysses, is one of the most familiar characters in all of Western literature. His stories have been told and retold. But what if he could give his own account of the Trojan War and his long trip home? Would he engage in what we might, well, today call spin? And that's one of the questions that you may well be asking yourself if you have the opportunity to read a newly published novel, which is titled The Lost Books of the Odyssey. And we'll be talking with the author, Zachary Mason. He imagines that a collection of fragments have been found. These are little pieces of the story that maybe we have come to know. You have probably read some of or know of the Iliad and the Odyssey. But the idea is here, there's a little fragments that pieces of the story that Homer left out, or maybe he didn't even know. And one of the things that they do, I think, is they prompt us to take a look with a fresh eye at some of these very old and well-known stories. The book's been out for just a little bit now and has been getting very good reviews. Our guest, Zachary Mason, the author, is a computer scientist who specializes in artificial intelligence. He was a finalist for the 2009 New York Public Library Young Lions Fiction Award, and that was really the thing that helped bring his book to the attention of a wider audience. He makes his home in California. He's talking with us by telephone. And as we talk, certainly questions are welcome if you'd like to call in. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We also have email, so you may write to will-talk@illinois.edu and get in your questions that way. In any way you want to do it, by calling, by writing, certainly comments and questions are welcome. Mr. Mason, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Congratulations. I have not read a single bad review of this book. Even the dreaded Michiko Kakutani at New York Times liked it, and she's pretty hard to please.
Oh, I'm told that it's the best review she's given in living memory. So
that what a remarkable thing to be able to say, knowing about how difficult she is. Well, I enjoyed reading the book very much, one of the things, among the many things that I'm really struck by is that you're certainly not a classicist. You hadn't had formal training in the classics. As I understand it, you really haven't had formal training in writing. You didn't really spend a lot of time going back to the source materials. You didn't spend hours and hours poring over Iliad and Odyssey and things that had been written about Odysseus?
That's right. So although it strikes me as kind of absurd and almost criminally negligent in retrospect, I didn't reread the Odyssey while I was writing the book or preparing to write the book. There was one book about the role of the Odyssey in literature through history that I read, but otherwise I just worked from memory. And to some extent this was deliberate insofar as with what I was trying to do, it seemed most appropriate to work with the memory traces of the book, whatever aspects of it were so strong that they had stayed with me, even though I hadn't read the book in years.
Well, I think that probably says something about how significant these stories are, that we're all quite familiar with them one way or another, at least the basic storyline, of the war, and then the basic storyline of what happened to him while he was trying to get home.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the way that you like to work is you have little pieces, little bits of things that you write down and you save and you collect, and that what you did was that you went back when you decided you wanted to put something bigger together and looked at those pieces? And did the idea of the project just emerge from those pieces?
Right. So it's more the case that that's how I used to work. Mm. So I wrote for a long time, sort of in secret. And in that time, I was just writing, as you said, fragments and sort of adumbrations of stories. And I never finished anything as substantive as a short story for the first, 9 years I was working. And there came a point when I decided that if I was going to be serious about writing, I had to do a book. So I was looking through my notebooks, and I found, say, 10 fragments that caught my eye, and I sort of collected them in a new file, and they sort of implied the shape that became the Lost Books. So in a sense, I discovered the book as much as I wrote it.
Mm. The stories that ended up in being codified as Iliad and Odyssey, these stories were old even in Homer's time, even if there was such a person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as far as the ancient Greeks were concerned, the Trojan War was ancient history. So these stories about these archetypal characters had been around for a while. What do you think, as far as they were concerned, of those people who was concerned, what do you think would have been the appeal of these stories?
For the Greeks?
Yeah, and what I want to do is maybe go on and ask a bigger question about what is the appeal to us. And maybe it's the same, that the appeal to them would be the same as the appeal to us.
That's a good question. To some extent, they're just really good stories. They somehow cut reality at the narrative joints. And then, of course, all of Greece is involved. So if you're a Greek, it's probably gives it an extra little bit of interest, seeing how many ships your city sends to fight the Trojans. If we're thinking about classical Athens and the like, the Trojan War probably seemed very topical, what with Persia always threatening to invade. So that would be my guess.
Mm. And for us now, so long after, why do you think it is that these stories continue to have such appeal?
That's a good question. So to some extent, they're famous for being famous. The Iliad and the Odyssey are sort of the essential foundation stones for the Western canon. So they have very high status, and everyone's read them, and so everybody is obliged to read them in perpetuity. And then people have been sort of tinkering with them time out of mind, using them as subjects for painting or as starting points for their own literary work. So that's entrenched them further. And then with the best literature, I feel like it's kind of outside of time, and its appeal goes beyond the culturally specific. Like with Odysseus, for instance, it's no great stretch of the imagination to see his journey metaphorically, and as such is something that can resonate with anybody who is a little lost or trying to get home.
Mm. That's, I guess maybe that gets at the question of why Odysseus really emerges here as such an important character. As far as the war is concerned and the Iliad is concerned, there's a pretty big cast, although you also have to say that Odysseus was a very important player in all this. So he's an important player in that big story. And then he gets his own book. We have this enormous story that's just basically about him. So then that seems to invite the question, well, clearly there's something about this man or this character that has really grabbed people for a long time.
So I think that Odysseus feels like the most fleshed out of all the characters in the Trojan War. Mm. Maybe Achilles is equally well-developed, but Achilles is a less interesting person. Odysseus's primary attribute is intelligence, and this distinguishes him from all of his peers. That's my answer.
Yeah, so that he somehow seems more, you know, of all of these characters, that he somehow seems the most real, like he could have actually been a real person.
Yeah, Homer definitely isn't psychological fiction, but he approaches that most nearly in the way Odysseus is handled.
That I find myself again going back to this idea that even to the ancient Greeks, this was ancient history. And one of the things I wonder, I don't know if it's an important question, but you wonder, did any of these people actually exist?
A good question. I don't think it's even clear that Homer existed.
Well, yeah.
I think it's irretrievably lost in the mists of history. I think there's some archaeological evidence that there was a Trojan War, or perhaps a sequence of Trojan Wars, but whether any of these people, or even a sort of model for any of these people, existed is an unanswerable question, unfortunately.
Yeah, just even the basic one, you have to wonder about the basic premise of the war, that one man's wife runs off, and that somehow he manages to persuade these other men to head off to this long and disastrous war on his behalf, and you have to wonder why the rest of them didn't say, well, friend, tough luck there, get yourself another wife, we're not going. And in fact, Odysseus himself does not want to go. He is not really such a willing participant in this adventure.
Oh, yeah, he feigns madness because he's perfectly well aware that the war is going to be a disastrous waste of time. Actually, what you bring up, this sort of whole episode of the gathering of the Greeks to go to war, is an interesting one insofar as you suggest, it's totally implausible. No matter how proud Menelaus was and how loyal the rest of the Greeks were and whether they'd taken this oath to rescue Helen if she was kidnapped, which in Homer, or the precursors of Homer, they did, the whole thing is ludicrous. So you have to wonder what other narrative elements this evolved out of. Maybe there was some other more reasonable story earlier, or some sort of, I don't know, narrative necessity for just getting the war started. That evolved, which caused the betrothal oath to be invented.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose if the interesting thing is telling the story of the war, that's what you're really going to concentrate on. I guess you have to have some way to get them there. Yep. You have to have some precipitating event, and maybe that in the end that doesn't matter as much as that the whole thing has been set in motion.
Yes, any creaking old narrative device will do. They say you shouldn't look too closely at the making of laws or sausages. I might add stories, too.
Yes, indeed. Our guest in this part of Focus is Zachary Mason. We are talking about his new novel. It is titled The Lost Books of the Odyssey. It is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It is out recently. It is a very entertaining reading. He's a computer scientist who specializes in artificial intelligence. This is his first novel. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm just also thinking about the fact that in some of these stories, you play with the idea that the story of the war has been written before it even happens. You know, the question, and then you find some different ways to look at that. You know, maybe the story of the war was written by the gods. Who knows who wrote it? But that the people who ended up playing these parts, they didn't know it, but their part was already written before they even got on the boat and headed over there. Is that something that's just about fate, or is that something about how wars ultimately never really make much sense?
I think it's more about how I saw imagined the Iliad and the Odyssey not as just some book, but as essential books, books that were so central that they were non-contingent. And so I was playing with that idea, as though these books were written into the very structure of math or narrative.
Talk some more about that.
So there's this idea in Islam that the Quran is a non-contingent book, that it's an essential aspect of the universe, or roughly speaking, I'm no Islamic scholar. But that idea is really appealing, and the sort of status and longevity and importance of Homer in Western culture make one almost think that they're books like that. So maybe they're not important just by chance or because Homer did a good job writing them, but because there's something really fundamental about them. So I started playing with that idea.
Hmm. And in the sense that there are some, that maybe the reason that some stories appeal to us is that they're so fundamental, they're almost outside of time?
Yes. Or I wasn't so much exploring why the stories appeal to us, mm-hmm. but starting from the assumption that they were
that they do
special things.
Yeah.
What happened then, and what does this imply for the characters? So the part of what I was doing was making Odysseus aware of the fact that he was in this narrative, not only this narrative, but this always changing sort of unstable narrative that sort of always had the same center, but was constantly taking new forms and seeing what the implications of that were.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, another interesting thing that you do with it is that you take the basic story elements, the things of which we're aware, but then ask questions or pose questions. Well, what if at this point where we know the story that it turns this way, well, what if it turned the other way? Instead of taking a right turn here, what if it took a left turn and really went in a different direction? You know, what if, for example, what if Odysseus finally, after all this time, gets home, and rather than the version that we know where his wife waited all this time holding off all these people who wanted to take over, what if at some point she had just figured, well, Odysseus is dead and married somebody else, and suddenly he arrives and finds out there's somebody else there? And that's just one example of ways in which you've said, well, you know, the story follows this path, but it could have followed this one.
Yeah, so part of the book I think of like a Baroque fugue. There are a few elements whose combinatorics I explore. So, for instance, Odysseus comes back to Ithaca, I think, 5 times in the book. And in one of them, she's a ghost, and in another one, she is kind of a monster and dispatches the suitors herself. And in another one, it's sort of Odyssey verite. It's what might actually have happened. So instead of being this superhuman paragon of virtue, Penelope, in fact, waited a long time and then gave up and got remarried. And so he finds her sitting with her husband in their house instead of finding the house filled with suitors. And he can't quite believe it because there were a lot of other things he could have done instead of spending a decade trying to find his way back home. But then in what is either a really subtle piece of self and narrative awareness or what is a psychotic break, he decides that, in fact, this isn't actually Ithaca that he's found, that his wife hasn't actually just abandoned him, that this is some illusion, something put together by a god who hates him, and he flees, determined to find the real Ithaca somewhere else in the sea. And so this is the first chapter of the book and a sort of entree into the other Ithacas he finds.
One of the things that that I found myself thinking about and I wanted to ask you about it is that is this, that certainly the Odyssey makes a great story. And you could imagine that it would be entertaining as a great story. And yet at the same time here, I suppose you could be a little critical of Odysseus because here and there it doesn't, you have to wonder, well, did you really want to get home? I mean, what exactly is going on about the way that the journey went and the fact that he, in fact, spent time with some other women on his way home and then arrived home expecting his wife would have been faithful to him all that time. So it comes to the question, well, other than being just an entertaining story, what exactly is the point of the Odyssey?
That's a good question. I think you can approach it on many levels. So the easiest level is as a sort of tale of fantasy. There's a mighty, quick-thinking hero, and he encounters various obstacles and monsters and defeats them all, and then he gets the girl at the end. A sort of more interesting way of approaching it is in terms of how it feels, Odysseus' relationship with the women and how he would have felt about getting home. And then another level on top of that is looking at the things that don't quite make sense or match up, the sort of holes and empty spaces in the story. Like, did Odysseus really want to get home, or was he, in fact, enjoying his journey? And what about Athena? So she didn't talk to him between the time he left Troy and got back to Ithaca, despite the fact she had been profoundly committed to his well-being. So what was going on there? And in any case, we know that Odysseus is a fluent and delighted liar. So how much of his story can we really believe? And then there's the fact that the Odyssey is actually narratively pretty complex. There are a lot of different people telling the story, and Odysseus is just one of them. So we have to wonder who has what kind of agenda. And it starts to feel like you can just give the story a little bit of a push and it will come apart into the kind of thing I did with it.
Yeah. I'm sure that individuals probably have particular favorites among the lost books. And I think that many of the reviews talk about number 18, the Iliad of Odysseus, which is a wonderful little story. And this is the one where essentially we get a very different kind of a person than the heroic character that we've come to know, which maybe is rooted in, you talked about the fact that in the story, in the Iliad, Odysseus doesn't want to go and pretends to be mad, but ends up going anyway. And this is what you envision here is, after the war, a future for him as a storyteller. And this puts him into the interesting position of being able to create his own character, to create himself, and to essentially tell any story as someone else, as an anonymous storyteller, to make up the story of Odysseus. And he essentially says, well, I might as well, I have the opportunity here to make myself a hero. There's nobody else around to contradict my story, so I might as well make it a good story and make myself the hero, which he does. And I'm sure everybody likes that story a lot. I mean, I like that story a lot. How did you come to be thinking about it that way?
Well, I was thinking about who Odysseus really would have been. So in Homer, all of the heroes, including Odysseus, are these sort of, you know, bronze demigods who clearly spend a lot of time in the gym and have no fear of anything. They just beat their chests and run into battle at the first opportunity. And I can certainly believe that that's what most of the aristocracy was like in the Bronze Age, but it seems like Odysseus would be someone different. I imagined him as a very intelligent person and maybe somebody who wasn't as enthusiastic about senseless violence as his peers. And from there, it was a small step to make him, in fact, quite untalented at fighting. So this put him in the awkward position of being very intelligent and articulate and averse to violence, despite the fact that his social position absolutely required it of him. So he then tried as best he could to get out of his military obligations. So Agamemnon came to Ithaca in order to collect him to go off and fight with Troy. And in this version, instead of feigning madness and plowing his fields with salt, I have Odysseus feign epilepsy, insofar as that has no symptoms that the Bronze Age people knew of, besides the seizures. And embellishing on his tale, he talks about how Pallas Athena visits him during these episodes and tells him secrets, which has the useful effect of accounting for his relationship with her and Homer. So he's basically this this kind of hapless intellectual nerd surrounded by these muscle-bound, bloodthirsty jocks and sort of obliged to pass as one of them. And then the war ends in disaster, and most everybody is killed, and the Greeks and the Trojans are scattered. And Odysseus has no way of getting home, so he just pretty much drops his helmet and walks away, eventually finding himself in another city in Asia Minor, where, lacking other recourse, he sort of sets out a shingle as a bard. And he finds that he's good at it, as he always suspected he would be. That was what he wanted to do when he was a child, rather than being a warrior. And then he finds that nobody else is telling these stories, and everybody else who is there is dead or lost. And so he starts reshaping the war to suit his own purposes, mostly to tell a good story, but in part because it amuses him to reinvent himself as an epic hero instead of a sort of particularly thoughtful and effective coward.
Yeah, and that and not that this is a really original kind of observation, but I suppose that's an opportunity that to the extent that we all avail ourselves of that opportunity to be able to tell a story in the way that makes us the hero of our own story.
Yes, it's very difficult not to slant one's story as different for oneself.
We're at our midpoint. Our guest is Zachary Mason. We're talking about his new novel, his first, The Lost Books of the Odyssey, and published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. He's a computer scientist who specializes in artificial intelligence. This is his first novel. It was a finalist for the 2009 New York Public Library Young Lions Fiction Award. He's joining us by telephone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Do you think that there is some way, or what way do you think your writing is influenced by the fact that you do work with computers and you do have this interest in artificial intelligence?
That's a good question, and the answer is I'm not really sure. There's a certain stripe of literature that people who like books and also have a quantitative background tend to like the whole Borges, Calvino sort of thing, and my book bears some strong resemblances to them. So I guess that could be part of it. Otherwise, I don't know. Maybe a concern with the more formal aspect of the story and the sorts of operations that can be used on them. So the Lost Books has... more than a tincture of Ulipo, which was this literary society in Europe in the 70s interested in the intersection between math and literature.
Hmm.
So that's part of it.
Well, that's an interesting notion. I guess it almost goes without saying that there, you know, some kinds of art, there's certainly intersections between some kinds of art and math. Certainly there's an intersection between math and music. I wouldn't right away have thought that there would be a big connection between math and writing.
Well, so both math and writing are just expressions of different kinds of pattern. I'd say the primary difference is that with writing, the patterns are much more complex, and even a small piece of literature has a whole lot of them, whereas with mathematics, you're trying to get the simplest, most austere, and most detached and abstract patterns possible. And with Ulipo, some of the things they did were beautiful and some of the things were just sort of literary stunts. Mm-hmm. Although it must be said, some of the stunts also ended up being successful. Like there's Georges Perec's famous novel that doesn't use the letter E, which sounds ridiculous, but it's actually really good.
That must be quite the challenge, writing an entire novel without using the letter E.
It sounds utterly maddening, but he managed to do it.
Yeah. You didn't impose any kind of strange constraints like that on yourself?
I considered it initially. There were a lot of early shapes that the book almost took, but mm-hmm. didn't quite take. It was going to be a much more Ulipan exercise in the beginning. Like there was going to be this sort of formal calculus for the elements that went into each story, and each story was going to correspond to an island in this mathematically defined archipelago, and so forth. And then this turned out to be too hard, and I couldn't get anywhere. But there are occasional ghost traces of this remaining.
Mm.
Oh, and every story was going to be, I think, no more than a page to begin with, but now they go up to about 15 or 20 pages.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I liked about it, I guess I found attractive, was that while on the one hand, some of the stories have contemporary elements in them, or there are references to things that Homer, assuming that there was such a person, would not have known about. At the same time, something about the way that the stories read, they read like they could be very old, that I would accept them as being a very old story. Is that something you set about to try to do, to give it that sort of feeling, or did somehow that just, maybe it has to do with the roots of all of this, and that kind of would happen by itself?
So I think it's more toward the latter. So in some cases, I would use a Homeric trope or metaphor or something just for fun. But I didn't do too much of that. I mean, I definitely wasn't trying to imitate or pass for Homer. But the way I approached this book, I wanted it to be kind of bleached of authorship. I wanted everything to fit as close to perfectly as I could get it to with the rest of the book and the words around it, and not really to have anything to do with me. And I feel that I've been successful there in places, and that's maybe what you're reacting to.
Mm-hmm. There are, in the story, I think, in coming out of this basic story, I think there are some relationships that are particularly interesting, that is, relationships that Odysseus has with other characters. And one, certainly very important one, is his relationship with Athena, the goddess Athena. Interesting for, I think for a variety of reasons. One of the things about Athena, I think, is this really striking, is while it is other gods and goddesses have a lot of extracurricular sexual activities, she didn't. Which makes you then sort of think about what exactly this relationship between her and this human was supposed to be about.
Yeah, I think Athena is the most interesting of the gods. The others seem oftentimes like libido unbound by consequences.
Which is exactly what we're looking for in our gods, I think, probably. Libido unbound by consequences.
I suppose it's something to aspire to. But Athena is sort of a parallel of Odysseus among the gods, insofar as the other gods have their attributes, but Athena is somehow the only one who feels like a person. And she has a habit of taking heroes under her wing, and she is a virgin goddess, so she has no interest in sexual matters. In fact, she's very much a tomboy, usually going around in armor and not being shy about going on the battlefield, fighting hand-to-hand with Ares and so on. And I mentioned earlier that there is this unexplained gap in the Odyssey. So Odysseus, Athena carefully protects Odysseus through the war and then vanishes while he is going home and then reappears when he needs to kill the suitors. So it could be that this is just a sign that the Odyssey is, in fact, a pastiche, that there was once a different story of his homecoming, something a little less fantastical, but maybe some fairy tales got interpolated into the middle. So Odysseus is sort of wandering out of his own story into someone else's, and then he gets home and his own real story picks up again. But another way to look at it is that something happened between them, something that's not in the text. And it seemed evident to me that this could have been that maybe Athena decided she didn't want to stay a virgin goddess indefinitely. So that's where one of the stories comes from. Athena appears to him as he's getting ready to leave Troy and makes a sort of clumsy pass. She has a prepared speech, which she goes through too quickly. And Odysseus loves her, but he just can't do it, and that's the root of many of the problems that follow on for him.
Mm. We have a caller here. We'll bring him into the conversation. Other people who are listening, questions, comments, you can always give us a call. Talk with our guest, Zachary Mason, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here on our line one in Champaign, I believe. Hello.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. One or two comments or questions, sort of. I read the review, and I can't find it right now. It's frustrating me, of your book in the New York Times. And I haven't read your book. I very much look forward to it. But it mentions that you have taken no writing courses and so forth, mm-hmm. and it somewhat contrasted you with the MFA programs and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, given the fact that another book called The Program Era, all about MFA programs, has come out and just seems to love them, if you have any opinion in that area. And two, I think you touched on it, and it was also in the review in the New York Times, something that you have almost a mathematical approach to language in terms of writing or something of that nature. And I don't remember the review, and I can't find it right now, but I'll just hang up and listen, and I certainly look forward to reading your book. Thank you.
Oh, I hope you like it. Let's see. Questions in order. So the MFA thing. I've never been drawn to MFAs. It's not clear to me that writing can be taught or that art can be taught generally. I tend to think that graduate school is useful for things to the extent they represent a technology. So, you know, for neurosurgeons and diesel mechanics, I'm all for grad school, and maybe even for painters, because there's such a thing as technique. But with writing, it's not clear that there's this sort of quantitatively describable, correct body of thought that you can extract and lay down and imbue into new writers in some useful way. It all seems sort of inchoate. It always struck me that it was better to just read carefully, and that way you would absorb the great masters. So better to study with Borges and Joan Didion and Nabokov, or at least their books, if you have the opportunity. And then I had a parallel track in my life where I was doing math and then computer science. So it had never really occurred to me to not just go through and finish the PhD. So that's MFAs. And then the mathematical approach to writing. So I stopped reading reviews pretty early on. So I'm not sure exactly what the Times review said, but I certainly wouldn't say I have a sort of mathematical approach to writing. Maybe it's that I feel like I can articulate why some sentences work and some don't. And that's my major preoccupation, trying to find the subtle things that separate a working from a non-working sentence. So.
All right. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free. 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the things, of the many things that I've read that I wanted to ask you about that I thought was interesting, and I'm not really quite sure I understood this, but that future, in terms of future projects that you are working on or thinking about, a novel that really deals with artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. and what it would do would be to try to imagine that the stories that machines would tell, either they would tell themselves or they would tell each other. And I think that's how I understand it, but you can tell me if that's what it is that you're thinking about.
Oh, no, you got it right. Actually, you're the first person who's ever talked to me about that who's gotten it right. So, yes, this would be the literature of artificial intelligences, so not stories about them necessarily, but stories they would tell each other. So my inspiration for that is the fact that human stories all tend to look alike. You find the same sort of forms in different cultures. And, you know, the plot of Hamlet or King Lear is trivially easy to transfer into some culturally appropriate form for any culture you care to choose. There's just something so essentially human about it. And that's because I think cultural differences are superficial. All people are pretty much the same, and we have the same concerns and needs and preoccupations. So from there, I started to think about the fundamental alienness of AIs. I mean, no AIs exist as it is, but we can certainly imagine them. And there's no particular reason to think that their minds would look like ours, especially emotionally. So, you know, human beings need love and food, and they seek status and so forth. But the sort of abstraction of intelligence embodied in the machine would be interested in different things, mathematics and pattern and consciousness and the like. So I decided to try to find their essential stories. And this turns out to be an extraordinarily difficult project. I can work for 3 months and get one chapter of a few pages, or maybe nothing. But when it works, I think it really has worked. So if I can ever manage to finish it, I think it will be an interesting book.
The challenge, I'm sure, is immense is to try to get yourself to think in a different way. My mind starts to take off right away and thinking about, what sort of questions do machines ask themselves? I mean, do they think as humans do? Do they ask these questions like, who am I and where did I come from and why do I exist and what is the meaning of life and where am I going and in what way can I be connected to other people? Would you imagine that machines would ask the same questions?
On the philosophical end, probably. Although their experience of reality will be quite different from ours. I imagine that one day AIs will exist, and they'll exist in a mostly informational kind of world, just in computer networks. And they'll have this very sort of curious relationship with the physical world, insofar as it'll be very difficult for them to participate in it or even sense it, insofar as processing images to extract meaningful semantic content from them is very hard, and manipulating robotics in the world is very hard. So probably they'll just sort of be concerned with software-type issues. But they'll know it's there, and they'll know it's important, and they'll know that in some sense they exist in it. So it will be this sort of strange ghost world for them, and a source of speculation and something from which they feel permanently detached. So as far as getting inside the minds of the AIs, it's very difficult. I mean, to some extent, I'm forced to cheat insofar as the problem is unthinkably hard, getting inside the psychology of these complicated alien artifacts that don't even exist. So I cheat, and I usually cheat in multiple ways in each story, and it sort of comes down to, can I find a way to layer the ways I'm cheating successfully so that it all sort of is believable.
I find maybe because one of the things that I like to do for recreation is read science fiction. I find these things very interesting. I guess I think about the enormous challenge of doing this, whether you actually could do it, assuming that you could actually produce an artificial intelligence, given the strange features of its existence. I find myself wondering how you wouldn't keep it from just becoming psychotic right on the first day.
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I don't think psychosis exactly is going to be the problem. It's relatively unlikely that an AI is going to just set about becoming Skynet and oppressing humanity at its first opportunity. But finding the right way of balancing its simulated emotions, or if you don't want to say it has emotions, then it's sort of hardwired control and motivational structures, could be very difficult. I've often imagined that there's this sort of phase space of psychology, and sanity is this tiny little region within it, and then there are these sort of vast fields of the parameter space that correspond to various kinds of madness surrounding it. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what kind of psychological phase space the AIs have.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't really thinking about using a term like psychosis so much of it being homicidal in the sense that it would, be turned into an evil power trying to take over the universe or to destroy humans. I guess I'm thinking more along the lines of, what happens when you have something with that amount of intelligence, but whose only, in a sense, whose only real reference point for anything is itself.
Well, hopefully there will be other things for it to interact with, even if it can't interact with the physical world. Maybe there are other machines for it to talk to, and other software artifacts that maybe aren't fully intelligent. Like, I suspect that the future of AI is not like Lieutenant Commander Data, but more like artificial intelligence software engineers. So maybe one day there will be an AI revolution, and software will become multiple orders of magnitude more complex. And I think they also lend themselves to design. So designing buildings and artifacts and pursuing well-defined engineering tasks generally.
We're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 3 or 4 minutes left. I better get back to Odysseus here. Pull ourselves out of the far future and back, and throw us back into the far past. And I mentioned earlier that I think probably there are some of these stories that everybody likes or that a lot of people comment on. We talked about one of them. It seems to me that the other is very likely to be the very last one. That I also like very much. And this is a story that it's set when Odysseus is an old man, and he decides to take one last trip. And he gathers together what if his comrades are willing to go, and they get on the boat, and they sail off to Troy again. And it's interesting what they find when they get there. Well, maybe you can talk about what it is they find when they get there.
So in the final story, Odysseus is getting up in years, and he's told his stories so many times that he started to wonder whether they actually happened or whether he just remembers other earlier iterations of his stories. So he gets together his few surviving friends and lots of young men who are interested in doing great deeds like they've been hearing their whole lives he did in his youth. And they retrace his itinerary through the Greek islands. So they go back to Calypso's isle, but she's gone. And they go back to Circe's island, but her house burns down and she's gone. And so forth until they finally get back to Troy. And from a distance, you can see that the city is teeming and active. And he is happy because he expects them to know who he is and try to kill him. And that will be a good death. But it turns out that, in fact, Troy has become a sort of caricature of itself, a Disneyfied tourist trap. So they tie up the ship and run off into this version of Troy where there are actors portraying the great heroes and puppet shows and people selling candy on sticks.
I like this story very much. I'm not exactly sure why, but maybe it gets back to this idea that I talked a little earlier about there are all these wonderful larger-than-life character, semi-mythological characters in here, Odysseus and Achilles and Agamemnon and Helen and all these people, and you maybe one question one might ask, well, did these people ever exist? I mean, were there really real people behind the stories? And a story like that, I suppose one of the things that it makes me think of is, well, yeah, maybe they actually did. Now, maybe they didn't do all of those things that the stories say that they did, but that behind any great story, even if it's grown in the telling, maybe there's some grain of truth in there.
I would suspect that there are lots of grains of truth, like maybe Homer or his precursors or the Society of Bards or Homer or whatever. Found lots of little bits of things they could use in the world. So maybe Odysseus is a sort of compilation of character details from dozens of people. In any case, I find that that's how my stories end up working. So maybe he was the same.
Yeah. Another project you're working on, I know that in what I've read about you, you've said you don't really want to be known as the classics guy or the guy who does the modern versions of classics. But I also read that one of the things that you're working on is another book which is based on The Metamorphosis by Ovid, which is another sort of tome of the ancient world.
I had decided not to touch the classics again after the Lost Books because I didn't want to be the guy who made a career out of rewriting old books. And I stuck with that for a while, but then I sort of idly started working with Ovid's Metamorphoses, and it started working. And at first I was worried that it would just be more of the same, but I feel like it's not. It's about something essentially different. And so my hope is that it will sort of be complementary with the Lost Books and in some way form a meaningful unit. And then I'll really be done with the classics. And this time I mean it.
And then it's on to the life of the inner life of artificial intelligence.
Well, there's that. And there's also a more conventionally structured novel I'm working on.
Yeah. And you're continuing to work in the computer field? You're not going to abandon that to be a full-time writer?
I still work for a startup in Silicon Valley. And it's sort of tempting to stop and be a full-time writer, but I kind of like having a place to go at least for a while every day. If I spent all of my time in my apartment and coffee shops, I would go slowly mad, I think.
All right. Our guest this morning, Zachary Mason. He's a computer scientist, specializes in the field of artificial intelligence. He was a finalist for the 2009 New York Public Library Young Lions Fiction Award. And we have them to thank for the fact that we can all read The Lost Books of the Odyssey. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It's out now. Zachary Mason, thank you very much.
My pleasure.